I'm Tammy Vindonge, your host for Executive with a Cause. And today on the show, I welcome Pip Karen, the chair of Cleanup Australia, and their managing director, Terry Ann Johnson. And today we're going to chat about the good, the bad, and hard things about running a charity. Pip and Terry Ann, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tammy. Thank you for having us.
Pip, we've known each other for a while. In fact, we met on my last podcast. Terry Ann, I know we haven't met before, but in case you're not aware, Cleanup Australia is one of my favorite charities.
Well, I know that you've been actively involved because I've seen you in all the records. So I know a lot about you. Great to put a face to the name, Tammy.
Thank you. Well, it tells me you have a great CRM underneath all this, so we'll probably get into that at some point. For those people that are not familiar with Cleanup Australia, we do have an international audience. Could you, Pip, tell us more about the organization?
Yeah, so Cleanup Australia was founded by my father, Ian Kiernan, 33 years ago. So back in 1989, he started with Cleanup Sydney Harbour. And the inspiration for that first event was he was a solo yachtsman and a builder. And he was sailing in a round the world race and ended up in the Sargasso Sea. And that's meant to be one of the most pristine, beautiful parts of the world. But Dad was quite horrified by the amount of pollution that he found there, predominantly plastic pollution. And being the practical man that he was, he decided to do something about it in his own backyard, and that was clean up Sydney Harbour. And 40,000 Sydneysiders joined him for that first event. So he absolutely tapped into the sentiment at the time. And the following year, it became a national campaign with Clean Up Australia Day. And we've been going strong ever since.
30-something years, wow.
Yeah, 33 years.
So let's talk about the basic concept of what exactly is a cleanup. I think people have visions in their head, but it obviously could be as large as the first one. But there's also smaller ones, too.
Oh, absolutely. And our work extends beyond, you know, we're best known for our week of action, with Clean Up Australia Day being the first Sunday in March every year. But our work extends all through the year. You know, we know that our waste challenges go far beyond just one day. So we support the community and schools and businesses to clean up any day of the year that they choose. So we have around 1 million volunteers each year.
Wow.
And more than half of those join us in that week of action, and the rest of them all through the year. So we have some groups who might adopt a particular location that they clean up regularly. Others just pick a problem hotspot for that year that they want to tackle. So we support all sorts of members of the community doing their bit to help look after the environment.
So with that many events and 1 million volunteers a year, yeah. Terry Ann, how many employees do you actually have?
We have five of us.
Five.
So there are five in our team. So we're a lean, mean machine that definitely delivers above our weight.
Now, for an organization that relies on volunteers, that's not unusual for a charity, but the majority of your volunteers you never see. What unique challenges do you have with that?
The key element for us is their safety. So what we have in place is, you're right, because we don't see them and because they tell us where they're cleaning up, it's vitally important that we know that they are safe at all times. So we've spent a lot of time researching and working with councils. We have some fantastic relationships with councils right across Australia. And what we do is, when people tell us where they're going to clean up, we actually get that signed off by the council to make sure it's safe, and also that conditions haven't changed between the time when somebody has decided, yep, that needs some attention, to I'm actually going to go and do it. So it's a really case of us then gearing them up to make sure they've got the right equipment so that they remain safe, they've got the knowledge on what they need to do to stay safe, and that they're also in contact with us. So we're available 24/7, and we can help them at any point in time to make sure that their cleanup is as productive and as much fun as it can possibly be as well.
And what are some of the resources you provide to these volunteers?
So we provide them with gloves. Now, the gloves that we provide are like a lightweight gardening glove. They're a cotton-lined, plasticized glove, so they're a bit sticky, which means they can pick up things. You're not going to have stuff slip and break in your hands. And then they receive some bags into which they then put their rubbish for a collection by the local council. And so they get recycling bags and they get non-recycling bags. And those bags are either made out of a nice heavy hessian so that they're quite impervious to being torn, or they're made out of their bio bag. And the bio bags that we specially commission are very thick. They're like about the thickness of a David Jones Meyer bag, but they're made out of cornstarch and potato starch. And so again, they withstand ripping and tearing. And so they bag up all of the rubbish that they remove and they put it out for collection. So along the way, we provide them with guidance. So we have what we call a site guide, which is the Bible on how to run your location, and also lots of tips and hints on how to stay well, how to stay healthy, first aid tips and hints, making sure that the site supervisor, who is a volunteer, is as geared up and as prepared as they can possibly be.
Yeah. With this many volunteers, though, it's still challenging. Pip, you talked about the first one that your father did. I'm curious, how did you fund the first one? Because all these resources you're talking about, they do cost money. It's not like you can just create all these bags and gloves and things from scratch. You actually are providing them with a resource, even though all the workforce is a volunteer. How did you pay for that first one, and how do you continue to generate revenue to support that?
Yeah, it's a good question. And our funding comes from a number of ways. So we have donations from the general public, and every cent that we're given from the general public goes straight back into providing those free kit materials to schools and community and the education materials to schools. We also have partners who sponsor us and help, you know, pay for the materials that we provide. And then we have in-kind sponsorship as well. So they might help provide the materials we use or provide services to our organisation. So really with the first one, it started with sponsorship back then. And, I'm sure that my father was ringing around mates and contacts asking for help. But, you know, the way we do it has evolved as well, because that early one was very much bring your own gear to the Sydney Harbour event. And over time, it's evolved in that we're providing those resources to those groups to help them with their efforts.
I imagine over time, other things have changed too. I noticed, Terri-Ann, you've been with the organization for quite a long time as well. Operationally, in addition to providing them with more resources for the actual events, what else has changed?
The whole process of how we actually collect information from them has changed a lot as well. So in the early days, you had to actually send in a physical handwritten registration form to tell us where you were cleaning up. And we had mountains and mountains of paper all the way around the office. And we had huge big maps up on the walls where we would put little red dots on where all the locations were. And that was the only way we had a sense of the scope and scale of what we were doing. Now it's all electronic. So everything is digitized. So they now register online. We send them materials. If they don't want hard copy paperwork, it's all electronically dispersed to them. We collect data from people through online processes. So you can now tell us all about your cleanup, the number of volunteers you had, what they found, and what exciting things happened. You can post photos. So it's a lot more immediate. Both the dispatch and the receipt of information. So our engagement with a volunteer is now a lot clearer and cleaner, if you like, than it used to be, where there would be days of between the time that you put up your hand to say I'm interested to the time you actually received your materials. Now you can tell us this morning that you want to register and your kit will be dispatched to you that same day.
Yeah. Well, I imagine, though, there's been a lot of change in the last couple of years, and it's not just been COVID. It's actually been the bushfires and the flooding and such as well. And Pip, I heard you talking about just before the last Cleanup Australia Day, I know that there was a lot of impact up north by the floods. How has that changed the way that you've had to do things to work around all these issues? It certainly is probably not a new thing, but it just seems like there's more of it.
Yeah, well, it wasn't just up north in Queensland, it was New South Wales as well, as you know, with the flooding. And it was quite heartbreaking to go through that and see what those communities were suffering. And there were around 600 sites that we had to postpone just before Clean Up Australia Day because, you know, they couldn't go ahead. They were dealing with their own, you know, flooded homes and communities. So, but the beauty of what we do is we can support communities all through the year, and we know that from the floods in the Hawkesbury last year, that there is a time, usually around 6 to 8 weeks after the flood event, that they can see where the litter's collected, and they want that, you know, they want that concerted help from the community to come together and help clean up those hot spots. So we supported the Hawkesbury to do that at that time, and we'll do the same with the flood impacted communities this year.
Yeah, brilliant. Terri-Ann, I want to go back to the whole idea of data and how that's changed over time. I know I used to fill in forms when we hosted a cleanup day, and you'd ask us all these questions about, you know, what are we finding? And that's obviously really valuable, not just to you, but the local government as well. How are you collecting all that information and using it?
So, we collect it through various means now. We encourage people to send it in electronically because that's the quickest way to be able to just undertake your counts while you're immersed in the project or in your event, and then get it into us. And then that way, also, we can immediately start processing that data into the forms that we then share it with the CSIRO. We share it with state governments. We've used it extensively in our advocacy for resource recovery and waste management reform. So the banning of single-use plastic items, we go through all of that really valuable data that is provided to us, and we collate it all into all of those forms that we now need to be able to go to those people, those decision makers, and also to businesses, and influence their thinking about how they participate in the supply chain. And also how they're really actively trying to limit the environmental footprint associated with their goods or their services or their products. So it's vital information. And the other key thing for us is that we are very conscious that this data that has been collected for over 30 years belongs to the community. And so we provide it free of charge to anybody who wants it. We take out all the personal stuff, and we then make sure that we really focus on getting as wide a use of this knowledge that we're very privileged to be the custodians of on behalf of that community. That has, you know, it's a big effort to count your rubbish, as you've experienced, and
I
it's not a fun job.
have.
It's not exactly pleasant.
No.
It's not a pleasant job. It's a messy task at the end of the day, but it's really vitally important because what we're finding is the trends over the years. So we can see, and we can see, tell, and share the direct impacts of the implementation of a container refund
Yeah.
scheme. We can see that what that happens. We know that there's a big spike, and then we know it levels off, and then it all starts. You're going back down again, and we lose those plastics, and we lose those metals, and we lose those really valuable components. They're no longer in the environment. They're actually back in the resource recovery stream, the recycling stream. And that's what's really vitally important to us. And because that data is provided by the community, they are now actively engaged in the way that journey is progressing. And that's something they can be very proud of.
Yeah. Oh, where are you storing that data?
It's stored in a very, very extensive Excel set of
Oh, I might be able to.
spreadsheets.
We publish. We publish it every year. So we produce the rubbish report in the lead up to Clean Up Australia Day every year. So it's shared widely. We, as Terri-Ann said, because it, you know, it's collected by those very hardworking volunteers, and we want to make that public. So we share it with media, we publish it on our website. And the other interesting thing that Terri-Ann touched on briefly when she was talking about container deposit schemes is that we have evolved that over time in terms of the categories that reporting on to reflect what our volunteers are collecting. So now we're seeing, particularly through the pandemic, we've started collecting information around pandemic waste. So around masks and more single-use items, and we're seeing a trend towards things like e-cigarettes and Nangs and items like that. So as our behaviour changes, so does what ends up as litter. It reflects our changing habits.
I want to ask you about that, Pip, the Citizen Science Project. Could you tell us more about that particular project? Because I think it's very relevant to what you just said.
Yeah, so that was something that we launched for Clean Up Australia Day this year because, you know, we knew anecdotally that our volunteers are picking up so much more of these pandemic-related items. So it's not just the single-use masks, it's the things like the sanitised wipes, it's the coffee cups because cafes said no to the reusable coffee cup, it's the takeaway food packaging because we couldn't eat in restaurants. So we wanted to... as well as encouraging those that are willing to do the full rubbish report, we wanted to provide a quicker snapshot to get a sense of just how many of these single-use face masks and other common pandemic-related items are ending up as waste in the environment, as litter in the environment.
And what are you finding?
So we're still collecting that, and we'll look to releasing that information towards the end of the year. But it's as we suspected that, you know, we are seeing a lot more of those items ending up as litter. You've only got to walk down the street. I know WA is seeing it right now because they're still having mandatory mask wearing in most public places. So once that happens, you see a surge in them ending up discarded on footpaths and in, you know, parks and things. And, you know, the crucial thing we need to remember there is anything that you drop on the ground eventually ends up in a waterway. So we really wanted our call to action for Clean Up Australia Day to be strongly around, let's pick these items up and get them out of the environment before they end up in our waterways.
A couple of years ago, I hosted a cleanup of Lake Burley Griffin here in Canberra, and it was during the drought. And what was really interesting about that was it unveiled a lot of things that were lost in the lake a decade or two before that you would not have found any other way. I suspect that your Citizen Project is going to identify issues now, but is it you know, true that my feel is that you're going to continue to find these things in the environment for the next decade?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
And because the sad part is they're not going to break down or break up even. So, the worst case scenario is they break up into smaller pieces so they enter the food chain even earlier. But they're certainly not going to break down. And it's really interesting, even around around where we are in Sydney, we're finding that masks are still required in places like supermarkets and things like that. So where you're finding a lot of them and where our volunteers are coming back and telling us, it's the car park. So people get out of the area where they've needed to wear their mask and they can't wait to get it off. And so they get it off and they either inadvertently or surreptitiously discard it in some way, shape or form, or it drops out of a vehicle these things are just lying there and they get sodden and then they start to tear into smaller and smaller pieces and the fibres get into, they're really insidious and they're lasting a long, long time.
So given that this has been mandatory for a while in many places, not just here, but around the world as well, and just a precaution for many right now, what are the options for recycling medical goods like masks?
Yeah. You've hit on the hot topic, and one that we did talk about in the lead up to Clean Up Australia Day, is that this is an opportunity. You know, 2 years ago, who'd have thought that an everyday household item would be a single use face mask? It's an opportunity to look back at the design of these products and design them so they can be absolutely as safe as they can be for us, but also thinking about the environmental footprint that they leave behind. This idea that when we design a product, we think about its end of life. It's this sense of product stewardship. So, it's not just designing it and whatever, when it's, wherever it ends up, I don't That's not my concern. We need to think at the design stage, what happens? How do we capture those materials? How can we design them so they have less impact on the environment? So it's an opportunity.
So, question for you, Pip, because the organization for the last 30 years has really looked at reduction, but also really just picking up rubbish after people have already disposed of it in an untidy way. It feels like you're evolving. And just looking at your website, I noticed that you had links to suppliers that are using recycled products or recycled plastic products, and that seems to be something that's fairly new. Can you talk more about that direction in terms of how the organization may be changing operationally and also from a vision perspective?
Yeah, so our heritage has been, as you've said, about removing litter from the environment, and that's still a really important part of what we do, and we are a grassroots community-led organisation. But our evolution, our work that we do today is as much about preventing litter in the first place as it is about removing it. And that's, the important advocacy work we do. So we work with government, we work with like-minded businesses to bring about that change and move away from this linear approach that I've just talked about with PPE equipment, where we're designing for a circular approach, where we're thinking about how do we get these resources again at their end of life. And you were at the Plastic Summit a few years ago, you know the pledges that were made and some of the great progress that we've seen over the last couple of years in this country towards doing just that and investing in this idea of a circular economy where we, and this is what my father was talking about, 33 years ago, wasn't he, DA? The need to think of waste as a resource. We can't think of waste as something we toss in the ground and it's a problem for future generations. We need to think of everything as a resource and how can we design it so that we can get maximum life out of it and then capture it and reuse it again. So, that's a really important part of our work. But everything we do is about practical action and empowering the community and giving the community a sense of hope that, it's the small steps we take together that lead to great change. And we're trying to guide all of our stakeholders on that journey. So, yeah, I think we'll probably always be about picking it up out of the environment as well as affecting, real change to stop it at its source.
Yeah. And I imagine, Terri-Ann, for you as the managing director, as that vision changes a little bit, are not the overall goals, but just how you support those goals changes. With five people, that's not a significant number of people to support additional programs. So how do you see the operational side changing to meet this vision that Pip just spoke about?
For us, the key element here is the partnerships that we develop and the people that we bring on as part of those partnerships. Because every single organisation that partners with CleanUp shares our vision on what we want to achieve, and they're also very much on the sustainability journey. And let's be honest, they've got a lot more resources than we have. So what we do is we very actively encourage them to share not just their funds and their networks, but also their skills, because they have a massive bank of skills within their organizations. So every single one of them provides us with either knowledge or opportunity or people to actually make things happen. And a really great example, Tammy, you were talking about how is our data collection evolving. We're working with an organization called Slalom at the moment, and they have absolutely revolutionized how we collect, analyze, and then display our data. And that's a skill set that we just did not have. And so it's really vitally important whenever you're in a not-for-profit situation and you've got limited ability to bring the skills in-house, that you maximize the opportunities that all of your great partnerships are going to bring to leverage those skills. And they love it. I have to say, it's really, really rewarding from a corporate perspective when you think of the growth of volunteering days. But if you put your volunteering efforts into something which gives you a very tangible result and an outcome, whether it's a physical or whether it's a brand new way that an organization can run something, it's very rewarding. You can actually put your little tag on that and say, and this is exactly what the team at Slalom are doing. Yeah, they get such a buzz out of the fact that they have, as I said, revolutionized the way we are collecting, dealing with, and displaying our data.
Oh, it's brilliant that you have partners like that, because that was going to be one of my suggestions if you didn't have one in place. The evolution of data is obviously changing policy too. And I know that in our cleanup, one of the things I tried to find was right after the plastic ban, the plastic bag ban locally here in the ACT, was trying to count the number of plastic bags that we found. And over time, it got to the point where we might find one or two, period, which was proof to the local government that they made a hard decision, but they made a really good one for the environment. I imagine that you're using data very much the same way to influence policy. We could see that there's a lot of changes before the pandemic already with recycling and the ability to offload plastics we didn't want. Are you seeing anything change right now other than the medical waste that has been growing in related to that? Are you seeing any additional trends that are maybe positive?
Yeah, there's a lot of really good stuff happening. So it starts, if we start with the government level, it's starting at the federal government level. So we have targets now. We have a waste management plan, a federal national waste management plan in place, and it has targets associated with that. And that then feeds down to the states. And we're actually seeing a lot of implementation for the replacement with alternatives for a lot of single-use products, predominantly plastic. The focus definitely has been on single-use plastics, but other single-use items are being replaced with really great alternatives as well. So you've got the retailers that have taken all of their lines of single-use picnic off the shelf and replaced it with reusable items. You're seeing things like barrier bags being taken out of the supermarket chain now. So you don't have a barrier bag to put your vegetables in that is a single-use plastic bag anymore. It's now an alternative that is more easily disposed of or more readily sustainably disposed of or reusable. Mm. We're seeing, you only have to go shopping to see the number of people that are taking their own bags in.
Yep.
So it's a behavioural change as well. So it feeds right down then to the consumer. Each of us can make a more informed choice about the alternative that we want to adopt that best suits our lifestyle. You don't have to wear a hair shirt to be an environmentalist. It can actually be a really classy, sexy thing to do. Yeah, there are really, really, very, there are some really sexy water bottles out there at the moment, and there's some great reusable coffee cups. And you stamp your personality on them. They become part of your range of accessories that, that sets you up on who you are. And so you're making an informed choice to be part of the solution. Mm. So it starts at that federal government level. It goes all the way through the states, through local governments, through the retailers, the supply chain, and the consumer is a vital component as well.
Would you mind if I had to state an observation? Talking to both you, since this podcast is about also understanding the operations behind the scenes, you both have been there for so long. And Pip from your legacy and Carrie Ann as the managing director. I'm very curious to know how you split your roles. I think that's really interesting because every organization has a different role for its chair and the managing director or CEO. How do you split your roles between the two of you?
Yeah, it's a good point. And I think that, the relationship between the chair and the managing director or CEO is such an important relationship. And Terri-Ann and I have been really fortunate to share a good relationship and work very well together. And neither of us are precious. So we have good open conversations regularly. But really, my role is obviously, the chair and all the governance associated with that role and leading the board and selected and brought together a relatively new board after Dad died. But I also take on a spokesperson and ambassadorial role for the organisation as well. So I act as our media spokesperson and get involved in speaking events and various events where we're representing the Clean Up Australia brand, but so does Terry Ann. So we always talk about, where do we split it? How do we spend our time and what's the best use of our time? And then I'll let Terry Ann talk about her important role.
So my role is very much in making sure all of the operations run as smoothly as possible. So, as a CEO, you've got to make sure that the organization is financially viable. So you've got to make sure that your income streams are actually meeting or exceeding your outgoings to make sure that you are that you stay fluid, that your cash flow is working for you, that all of your team is participating to the best of their ability. They're also growing as individuals as part of being part of the organization, and that our partnerships are working as well for our partners as they are for us. Because for us, it is about partnership. It's about joining together because you've got a shared vision and also making that happen. So it's not just about delivering a whole heap of benefits for someone who gives you a check. It's more about what are we going to achieve together over this period of time that we're going to have the privilege of working together.
Yeah, so you manage those relationships?
Sorry?
So you manage those relationships, those partnerships?
Those relationships are managed by either me directly or by the team. Uh-huh. It depends on where the relationship actually came in. Yeah. So a lot of the time, if the relationship comes in through one of the team, then it's vitally important that team member remains involved. And similarly, a board member. If the relationship has come through a board member, it's vitally important that board member remains involved in that relationship as well, because that's how it came together. And our board is very much an extension of our team. Pip, I think Pip underrates the wonderful job that she did in recruiting the revitalized board when she took over as chair. She's brought on people who are very networked, they're young, they're keen, they're entrepreneurial, but they're also prepared to get down and get their hands dirty. They'll come in and they'll help us pack materials, or they'll go out to clean up sites and they'll go and get all muddy and dirty and really bunker in with everybody else. Mm. They're actively engaged in the organization and very committed. And that's every single person that that I've been privileged to work with through the years I've been here, or associated with through boards, and also partners, have been prepared to get down and get in there.
Yeah.
That's the vital thing.
And I think, Tammy, the other vital thing is, particularly for a charity, probably more so than a corporation, mm-hmm. is this idea of ethics. And ethics, you have to set the ethical tone at the top. So from the board to the CEO to every member of the team, it must be, you have to live and breathe those ethics, and you have to demonstrate how you want the organisation to be run, because we are the custodians of, donations from the public. We're trusted, and that's a really big responsibility, and one that we take very seriously. And we have got a highly ethical board and team, and I think that culture is just so important. It needs to flow through everything you do.
Mm. Well, I think especially with such a small team, it sounds like the board and the staff that are being paid are quite tight, and obviously those values are going to be absolutely critical to make that work, because you are such a large national brand despite the size of the organization that people would have no idea that you're as small as you are. Now, I understand, Terry Ann, you're going to be leaving soon after, almost 20 years at the organization. There's got to be both angst and excitement for you, and I suppose for Pip too, to think about the future and how things might change, because you've been so integral and part of the organization for so long. Can we talk about succession planning a little bit? Because anyone that's been there that long, you have to start to think at some point they might want to leave. How did you go about making this decision? I suppose probably together, just because you're so tight. And then what are your plans for making sure that that succession change is successful?
Smooth, yeah. Well, I think, you know, I guess the overwhelming emotion for me is gratitude to Terri-Ann. Gratitude for the professionalism she's brought to the role and the heart and soul that she's put into the organisation, you know, working with my father and now with me. I feel very privileged that I've had the opportunity to work with her and to have that passing of knowledge and, you know, those pearls of wisdom that she shared. So, you know, it's a lovely transition. I think, you know, it's so fortunate that, you know, we have such a great relationship and that Terri-Ann could do it when she's ready. And she feels the time's right. She feels that the organization's in just such a healthy state that it is a good time to have a changing of the guard. And I think you need to be open in those conversations, which we always have been, and so is the board. And one of the most important functions of a good board is to ensure that you are thinking and talking about CEO succession, as we always have. So we're going through that process now of recruiting those big shoes to fill. But we've got, you know, it'll be a nice orderly transition. Terri-Ann has said that she will stay with the organisation until we find the right replacement and make sure it's a good handover. But, you know, she's done a great job of making sure that it's a team that we've shared, you know, there is shared knowledge. We've got great plans for the future and, you know, a nice cohesive board, good, we're clear on what the organisation stands for and our, you know, our ethos and principles. So we're in great shape and... Yes, it's a heavy heart that we say goodbye to her, but we're not saying goodbye. We'll be keeping her close. So.
I'm sure she'll be recruited for every cleanup day that you have. Getting her hands dirty.
As part of that handover too, yeah, we've been really consciously for quite some time now. So as the team was recruited and settled in, each one of them has been asked to document all of the procedures that when they came in just weren't quite so obvious to them. And so what we've built up over time is a bank of experience, which is documented experience. And so we go back and we revisit that on a regular basis, just to make sure that if one of us isn't around at any point in time, somebody else can walk in and be able to undertake that person's role for a period. And I think that's really important. And it's one of the, it's a bit like the McDonald's philosophy. Yeah, there's the most senior people of McDonald's also go back behind the counter on a regular basis. And so that's what we've always tried to do. There's no hierarchy at Cleanup. It's a very egalitarian organization and we all pitch in and help one another out. So it's vitally important for us, or really important for us, that we all understand how things operate and what needs to be done to ensure that our volunteers, whenever they ring in or call us or need us for anything, get the consistent best advice and best practical assistance that we can give them from whoever they talk to at any point in time. So we've actively done that and we'll continue to do that. And yes, every now and then something will happen now that, you know, if we're all in tune on the fact that I will be going, and someone will say, oh God, TA, where do you get that? This is where you get that. So you just write this down and make sure that, so there'll be lots and lots of time frames and timetables and things left for the new CEO. And yeah, as Pip said, I'm quite happy to spend time with my successor to help them settle in and then be available if they need it. Look, they may turn around and say, you know what? Off you go. This is my show now. You can go. And that's fine too.
Well, I think
I will absolutely respect how the new CEO wants to do that.
Yeah. Well, at the same time, I think some good advice about just being cognizant of documenting your procedures, no matter how big you are. I think some people think it's a luxury when you have a bigger staff, but the reality is you need it even more when you're smaller. I have just one final question, because I'm conscious we're out of time. Just there's a lot of things that you guys are doing now. It looks like you have a lot of new programs that are happening. If people want to get involved in a Cleanup Australia Day, any day of the year, what should they do?
Well, it's so easy because it's all on our website. So you can go to cleanup.org.au and you can register your event, or you can see on our website the various ways you can get involved. I mean, we have things like a plogathon where you can walk and pick up rubbish at the same time. You can do that with a small group or on your own. We have people who get sponsored in their plogathon and then donate the funds to Clean Up Australia. You can make a pledge of, you know, a simple change you're making in your daily habits and share that on our social media channels. You can make a donation to help us continue the work we do. There's so many ways to get involved, and it's easy to find it there on our website. And there's also lots of resources to help you make those everyday changes that we've touched on, that you know, that each of us can be part of that journey towards being more sustainable.
So that's cleanupaustralia.org?
cleanup.org.au.
Okay.
cleanup.org.au. And I think, Tammy, where it starts is, next time you're out and about, or any of your listeners or anyone watching this is out and about, just stop and have a look around you. And yeah, next time you're racing through the park to get the bus or the tram or the ferry or whatever, just actually stop and have a look and see if there's rubbish accumulating. Because if there is, that means that you can be part of the solution by letting us know about that and by getting some friends out there to help you, which is a really simple and rewarding act of picking up that rubbish. And then once you start seeing it, you won't stop seeing it. It's really, you know, and it's lurking underneath all the bushes, and it's all out there waiting for us to intervene, to stop it getting into our waterways, wherever they are, and to stop it harming our wildlife.
It's a good point, and it's prompted me to think that, you know, there's also many ways that we have for businesses to get involved.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's lots of great team building activities that businesses love to participate in with Clean Up Australia. So whether that's, you know, training that we can provide, some online training for teams, or running a team event to clean up. There's lots of different ways that organisations are getting behind the cause.
Great.
You're never too old, you're never too young, and you're never too busy.
Thank you. I tell you, Pip and Carrie-Anne, I probably have done, I don't know, at least 5 or 6 cleanups in the last couple of years alone. And I would agree with you that there's, once you see it, you can't remove it from your sight. You see it everywhere. And the things that you both do and your organization does actually make a huge difference to not just the one day that somebody cleans up things, but also from an educational perspective of getting people to change their ways and to get businesses behind that and policy makers too. Thank you for the work that you do, and we really hope that that we get to see even more exciting things in the future. Good luck to you, Terri-Anne, as you move into the next chapter of your life, and Pip, as you start thinking about the future of the organization with a new CEO. I'm really excited to see what you guys do next.
Oh, thanks for having us, Tammy. So lovely to chat with you.
Hi, this is Tammy again. When I'm not doing podcasts, I'm helping not-for-profits with their IT decisions. In this week's segment, IT in Plain English, I have another question. And this week's question is, how can I avoid blowing my budget on an IT project? This is a really good question and something that happens a lot. Now, I've been on all sides of an IT project. I have been the procurement officer, I've been the customer, I've been the vendor, and I've been the implementation project manager, and I could tell you I have a lot of scars and wounds because of these projects. But the number one piece of advice I can give you for any IT project is to avoid customizing the system. Now, I know there's a lot of reasons why you might want to do something different or special, but the reality is that this is where the majority of your extra costs will come from. The better thing to do is to try to find a solution that already meets your needs. So that might be from a functionality perspective or even the workflows that you have. Because remember that the vendors will be creating their workflows and functionality based on the majority of their own clients that they have already. And that's usually best practice. So if you can, change your processes to meet the system's needs rather than trying to change the system to meet yours. I guarantee you, you will save a lot more money by doing it this way. So hopefully that will get you started with a question in IT. If you have a question for me, just feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn. I'm happy to take any direct messages where I might actually answer your question on the air. So for those of you who are executives of the cause, I just wanted to say thank you to you and your teams for the work that you do on a day-to-day basis. You are making a difference in this world, and we really thank you for your work.